This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Frank Macon, 96 years old, of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Nationwide, there are fewer than 50 pilots remaining now who earned their wings outside of Tuskegee, Alabama in World War II as part of the then-segregated U.S. military's aviation program for African-American servicemen. Frank is one of them, and his life story has taken some twists and turns he did not expect. You can read all about it in his new book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, which we have linked for you online. And Frank, you mentioned that by the time you were in high school, you had already soloed at Pine Valley Airport, now on the U.S. Air Force Academy property. So I guess you'd come a long way from jumping off the top of the chicken coop, and you were achieving some of your aviation dreams. But how were you doing in school?
Terrible. I'm very dyslexic, and they didn't understand that problem that people that are dyslexic have. And now they, of course, they're farther advanced in it, and they're helping a lot. But I did have a very good memory, so that helped a lot. I learned by the words would move around on the paper in a book or something, and numbers were just terrible. And if I put my finger on them, and use my finger, I could stabilize the words a lot better. And so that's how I learned to read.
But you kind of had to figure that all out on your own? No one was helping you?
Yeah, I just figured it out on my own. But anyway, it was really strange. Today, I can't figure out how I passed those tough tests that they gave us to be able to fly. But a lot of the questions they asked had to do with science and physics, and I really enjoyed physics and chemistry and auto mechanics and the things that we did in, I'll say, junior high school and high school here in Colorado Springs, and I got quite a good education in that field, and physics was one of my favorite subjects, and how things work, and it just always amazes me, even today, how the creator put this world and the whole creation together. Many years later, I'm jumping ahead, I retired from civil service at Fort Carson, and I was asked to join a research company. I'm just awed by how wonderful that this world and the creation, and it just amazes me how the trees know when to turn, when to put the leaves on, when to drop them, when to and just all of that. I'm just like a little 10-year-old kid. I'm just always amazed at everything.
Well, there's a lot of scenery around here that can amaze you, too. You said you've been in this neighborhood pretty much your whole life, and Pike's Peak, I think we could throw a rock to if we had a good enough arm out your back porch here, and the Garden of the Gods not too far away. I guess there's a question, too, just out of curiosity. Did you have much opportunity to explore the nature around here as a boy?
Oh, yeah. We were always hiking the mountains and whatnot and picking up different minerals. Of course, the grade school I went to, this neighborhood was either gold miners or coal miners. Of course, there was always an argument which one of them was a miner, but and they expected us to fall in line with our parents and some in the mining industry. Geology, I learned a lot just because they felt that we were going to be miners.
You were talking about how good your memory is, so I've got to ask you about December 7th, 1941, because most of the people I've met who are alive then have some kind of memory of how they found out what happened out at Pearl Harbor. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Well, what I remember is, as I said, I always wanted to be a pilot. I was driving at 14, probably driving before them because, but anyway, my great uncle just went down to the police station. He couldn't drive, and my mama had arthritis real bad. And he asked, said, that kid knows how to drive. Is all right if he's driving? And they said, oh, yeah, as long as somebody's with him. Now, I took them to a friend's house. I don't know. I was just driving around with the car. There's a girl that used to live in the neighborhood, and I went by to see her, and she says, Well, I guess you're going to be a pilot now. And I said, what? And she says, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And I said, what's that? You know, I never heard of Pearl Harbor. And that's how I actually got involved. Of course, turned the old car radio on, and between the static and whatnot, and they were talked about that. I joined the Civil Air Patrol, and then this is where I really started learning about airplanes, and they would take us flying and teach us how to manipulate the controls, you know. My coordination was always been good. I was on the tumbling team and things like that, you know. And when I graduated from high school, they said they've started a new program in the colleges and started teaching. They told me about Tuskegee. I never heard of it, but, you know, and it was in Flying Magazine. They told me that I could go to there, the college, and the government would pay for it, you know. And I had to go to the new Customs House in Denver and take the test to see if I could qualify. They wanted to put me in the Army Air Corps, and I said, well, I'm supposed to go to the civilian pilot training program. And they called me in and said, you're too young. You have to be 21 to get a commercial license. And so they sent me home. Even after I'd gotten out of school, I would not have been 21, you know. So I came back, went back to work at the old garage, working on automobiles. So the draft board started looking at me, and I went back, took the test, and I got in, and then went to Keesler Field. Boy, oh, there was some tough tests, and a lot of was about your physical coordination and whatnot. But you had to have 2 years of college to go to flight school. Well, I just got out of high school, so they sent me to Tuskegee to college. I was there a little while, and I don't know, 3 or 4 months. They sent me to Maxwell Field to take the test again. And they said, well, you more than qualified for 2 years of college. And so then they sent me to the base.
And I'm just curious, because this is, you know, most of the people listening weren't alive during that time period. And maybe they've heard some stories, but they didn't live through it. The fact that our nation's military at the time was segregated, that Japanese Americans were isolated over here, that African Americans weren't serving with whites in the same unit. How did that strike you? Did that disturb you? Did it seem odd, or was that the way things were then?
I wasn't used to being down south, and I wasn't used to that because the school I went to was integrated. Native Americans, Mexicans, and blacks were all, and along Irish and everybody else was, you know. And so it was just really confusing to me. And water, I had to go into this bathroom or a toilet, you know, facility. Or I couldn't drink out of this fountain and all of that. And it was just really ridiculous. And I had just never been involved in anything like that.
And, of course, a lot of these pilots that you're studying with and training with had grown up in the South and had a much different experience. How eye-opening was that for you to glean some of what they'd been through?
The thing was that, well, I couldn't understand anything they were saying, and they couldn't understand anything I was saying. When they found out I came from Colorado, well, the first thing was, we're fighting the Indians all the time, you know. And, of course, I'd just play it up. And my grandfather was Indian. And they wanted to know, well, how do you do out there? I said, well, of course he wasn't. I said, well, my grandfather's chief of the tribe, you know. And the guys from Denver, there was some in there, you know, and they just help along with them. There was so many phraseology I was used to. I just had no knowledge of the way they talked, and it was really confusing. In basic, we were in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was strange. I don't know how to put it, but having to go to a separate restroom or something like that. And I said, well, I'll be glad I get out of this place, you know. And then, of course, got to Tuskegee. And Tuskegee's really not in the town of Tuskegee. It's in a place called Greenwood. It's a suburb. And if you went to Tuskegee, the town, the atmosphere was much different. You could just feel it, you know. But out in Greenwood, you just didn't see any whites. Of course, now when we got to, and our instructor were all black. But then when we got to the air base, started in basic and advanced, all of those were whites. And a lot of them are from the north, so they weren't too bad.
And, you know, with the lens of history, we can look back now and say that what all of you did during World War II, the African-American soldiers, sailors, airmen who risked their lives, laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement, that they showed our blood is just as red as any other American, that if we can die for our country, we deserve some rights. We say that now, but did you guys have a sense then that there was something you had a chance to prove?
Now, I don't know about the rest of the group, but I didn't feel that I had anything to prove. I knew what I could do, and I had learned to fly before I even went there, and they cautioned me here, never mention that you know how to fly. So I didn't, and an airplane was just as normal as an automobile to me. So my mindset was not as the others.
Well, you hadn't dealt with the degree of prejudice in your life that they had, I guess.
No, and the other thing is I felt much different than most of them because I just didn't seem to think like they thought, you know. I was practically raised with white people, you know, and they used to say that, what do they call it? Say that you're an Oreo, you're dark on the outside and white on the inside. You know, and I guess that's true, but I didn't realize it.
You said people here in Colorado Springs warned you when you get to Tuskegee, don't tell them you already know how to fly. Why did they tell you that? What was the concern?
The concern was that they would expect more out of me, or they may make it harder on me because, you know, I'm a smart aleck, I guess. That's the way I interpreted it, but I didn't tell them.
What all did you get to fly while you were there?
I got to fly the Stearman biplane, which was really a lot of fun, open cockpit and all like that, the real flying. Mm-hmm. And then I got to fly the Volte Vibrator, as they called it. It was a BT-13 made by Volte. Then the T-6, of which I really enjoyed flying the T-6. It was very maneuverable. Well, the Stearman was renewable, but it was sluggish and slow, you know.
And the T-6 is to prepare you to go overseas, and I'm sure you had ideas of flying one of those red-tailed P-51s, but that's not how it worked out.
No, just before graduation, I knew that I had my uniform, officer's uniform, and everything was hanging in the closet, you know, and I had a real nasty head cold, but I loved flying that T-6. And I said, well, I'll go to the dispensary after this flight. Well, I did, with blood coming out of my ears, you know. And of course, now that little incident just ruined my flying career. But I did get into a lot of flying, but not commercial type, because after I got out, but I got into maintenance and engineering and things like that, and had a fairly successful life, I'd say.
Well, yeah, and you're not done. In fact, now you've got this new book out that people everywhere are reading and learning some of this history, and I know part of the reason you wrote that book is to inspire young people, including those who battle dyslexia, as you did. But with the situation with that flight, where you just couldn't resist going up in that T-6, and you ruptured both eardrums, is that what happened?
Both of them, yeah. Uh-huh. And I was deaf for several weeks and in the hospital at the Scott Field. And then they sent me to radio code school, which brought a lot of my hearing back.
I'm just interested, because, you know, everybody has challenges in their life. Everybody faces adversity. It's hard when you don't know where the finish line is or where the light at the end of the tunnel is. And when here you've described how much you loved flying, and now all of a sudden not only can you not fly, you can't even hear for weeks on end. What was that time period like? What was going through your mind?
I got to get better. Was the best thing. I guess I'm a fighter, you know, and I don't dwell on what could be, and I dwell on what's going to be. And I'm still the same way. The war was over with when I finally got out of the hospital. But they sent me back to Tuskegee to finish up with another class. But when it happened, the war was over with, and they said I'd have to re-up because my time was real close of getting out. And I thought about it a while, and I said, oh, I know, I don't put up with this Greatest Service. I can go home. I know how to fly, so that's it, and I'll make it. But in retrospect, I can say I should have done it, but that was should have, I didn't. But they're bugging me to write another book about what I did do after I got out of the military, because I was kind of involved in a lot of science things and research programs, things like that. And I don't know what I can write and can't write, because I don't know how much is still secret and what is.
Well, that sounds pretty intriguing. And we can look forward, perhaps, to this 96-year-old writing another book. But there's quite a story about how his first book came about. Again, you can find that book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, linked at hometownheroesradio.com or his personal website, franklinmakin.com. More of Frank's thoughts on being one of the last remaining Tuskegee Airmen when we come back. Plus, we're going to hear from the woman who worked with Frank for 4 years to make his book a reality. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.